presentation on the TMGC. Mr. Neese.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This presentation is, I think, directly replies to a request we got from the council back in June for an update on the Transboundary Management Guidance Committee, or TMGC, and to some extent, the underlying understanding, notice I didn't say treaty or agreement, the U.S.-Canada resource sharing understanding, so that council members can better understand where it came from, how it interacts, and what it is. My intent today, along with the help of Dr. Cronin here, is to go over the genesis of the TMGC, a bit of its history, and to talk about its key elements. Then Jamie's going to talk about how the quotas that we established there interact with the groundfish fishery management plan, something that came up in great detail last year, but could come up again in great detail this year, so we want to make sure you understand it. One of the things I want to make clear is that later today, in fact, not very much later, but shortly after I talk, you're going to get a presentation on this year's Transboundary Resource Assessment Committee discussions, the TRAC. I'm not going to talk about that at all, or very little, I should say. And then after that, our TMGC co-chair, Ms. Etrie, will give a presentation on this year's negotiations and issues with the TMGC that were encountered this year. So just to be clear, my presentation is really background. I'm not going to get into any details of this year's discussions. That's going to come later today, just so you understand. Next slide, please. So I'm going to go back and go through a little bit of a history lesson here because I think it helps to understand what we're doing. It's not a surprise to you, most of you, I wouldn't think, but the U.S. and Canada have a long history of interactions over fishing rights. If you really go way back, you know, fishermen in the U.S. used to go up and fish off Newfoundland and had dried cod places that they would dry cod up there. They got kicked out at one place, point, they went back, et cetera, et cetera. Skipping forward to the 20th century, because all of that's old news, things really kicked off in 1945 with a declaration on continental shelf fisheries resources. And then, of course, in 1977, with the adoption of the Young-Studds Act, the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the fisheries issues became highlighted. Maybe news to many of you, but the U.S. and Canada actually negotiated a treaty in 1981 which would allow the vessels of both countries to fish within the EEZs of the other country. It was quite complicated, talked about who would enforce what and everything. That's all kind of just a historical footnote because the U.S. Senate refused to ratify that treaty and it never went into effect. And the reason they refused to ratify it was because of opposition primarily from the U.S. fishing industry. In large measure by the U.S. scallop industry. So because there wasn't agreement and it wasn't an agreement and there were still issues going on between the two countries, here's another historical footnote. I hate to refer to that in my own life, but back in the day, I was a Coast Guard officer out on Georgia's bank, and out in the area of eastern Georgia's, the U.S. and Canadian fishing vessels fished side by side through an agreement until the 1984 International Court of Justice border ruling, which established the boundary that we now have. You know, the figure here just shows the disputed area and some of the areas that were being talked about. It's just to be a pretty picture. Next slide, please. So from about 1984 till about 1995 or 96, 97, I think there were some desultory conversations between the U.S. and Canada over access, trying to figure out how to share Georgia's Bank and that type of thing. But it really accelerated after the passage of the Sustainable Fisheries Act in 1996 because we had rebuilding requirements that were embedded in law. The Canadians did not. And so there was a recognition, I think, by both countries that in order to successfully manage these fisheries, we needed to come sort of agreement. So the regional office and DFO started talking, you know, probably in the 96-97 timeframe. The scientists were always talking because they're always best buds and want to share data and everything. And about 1999, DFO and NIMS actually started up a process to try and come to some sort of understanding on how we would work. The council was brought into that process. There were a couple working groups formed. Joint meetings were held between 2000 and 2002, and a document was agreed on in 2002. It covered a lot of things. That document is included in your binder if you want to really read it. I'm going to go over some of the elements of that document, but I'm not going to go into it in a lot of detail. The understanding was implemented by our adoption of Amendment 13 on May 1st, 2004. Now, it's kind of interesting here because, as I say in bold red text here, this is not a treaty. This is not a treaty that's been ratified by Congress. There were a lot of reasons why we didn't want to go with a treaty. One of them, quite bluntly, was neither country wanted to get their Ministry of Foreign Affairs involved for fear that people would start trading fishing quotas for timber rights or whatever. So we wanted to keep it as a fisheries agreement that we dealt with fisheries issues. And so there was some discussion in the 2002 timeframe, you know, when the written document was first developed and agreed to, was about how are we going to implement this. And those of you may remember the Nike ad, "Just Do It." That's exactly what the council did. This would not be in place here, except that the council put it in and adopted it in their fishery management plan, and the Fisheries Service approved that, and it was implemented into regulations. I would point out that there have been long-standing science relationships, as I mentioned already, and those continued, and that's how the track gets involved here. That's the science side. So why did we do this? So I'm not going to read this long phrase, but this was kind of the problem statement that the U.S. side was using internally, the recognition that we needed to closely coordinate with Canada. You need to remember that the rebuilding requirements of the SFA were very stringent. Canada had no equivalent law. So we were looking at rebuilding requirements, and they were not. One of the comments that was made at the time, well, one of the issues was there was no agreement on what the fishing mortality rates should be for these shared stocks. We were anticipating that with some of our rebuilding requirements, our fishing mortality rate would be much lower than what the Canadians were using. At the time, they generally used F0.1. And both countries were kind of in a bind because you had to somehow account for what the other country was going to caught. You didn't know what they were going to catch in the future, so you were basing that on some assumption of the previous year's catch. One author wrote, "The underlying motivation that fueled the effort to reach an agreement was the recognition that each country's independent conservation actions could be compromised and the full benefits of management actions were more likely to be realized if there was a consistent management by the U.S. and Canada." Next slide, please. So there's a couple, what I'm going to call key elements, and I'm not talking about the track, I'm talking about the key elements of the understanding as it relates to management. First is we agreed on the area. Second, we agreed on the stocks and or management units that were covered by the understanding. Third, we agreed on a harvest strategy. Fourth, we agreed on a allocation formula. And I think the fifth thing, and this is pretty important, is we both sides agreed on accountability. In other words, we were going to make sure that our fisheries remained within the quotas. So the thing you have to understand is all of these elements really were negotiated. I think the stocks management units was probably the easiest one. We very quickly settled on cod, haddock, and yellowtail flounder. But without going into excruciating detail, because some of these things changed over time, the general U.S. approach was, let's try to get an agreement that we think would be to our advantage when the stocks are rebuilt. And, you know, there's the expectation was that a rebuilt haddock stock would be of great benefit to the U.S. and would outweigh the benefits of the other two stocks, yellowtail flounder or cod. And I think there's some indication that maybe that was true, but that's always a debatable point. Let's talk about the area that was covered. It's notable at the time Canada walked in the room and so the box on the screen, if you look at it, the big box is the entire area for the U.S.-Canada understanding, and Georges Bank yellowtail flounder stock area matches that. So that's why Georges Bank yellowtail flounder is a whole stock. The red line is basically the eastern area, which is why we have an Eastern Georges Bank Cod and Eastern Georges Bank Haddock management unit. It's kind of worth noting that originally the Canadians walked in the room and said, let's use the whole side for all three of these. And it was the U.S. that refused. All right, so the U.S. wanted the eastern area. At the time, the U.S. wanted that because we didn't want Canada reaching their fingers into U.S. management because of the rebuilding requirements. We figured the smaller area would be better. So that's one element. Next slide, please. So the two countries agreed on a harvest strategy advice, harvest strategy, which is the basis for the scientific advice, and this is still technically the strategy that's in place. First off, we negotiate a fishing mortality rate that was what we refer to here as F reference. We call it FMSY or a proxy for FMSY, but in this case, it's F ref. And I want to emphasize it was negotiated at the time. We agreed on what the F ref was. And over the years, there's been a lot of griping by the scientists that that number no longer reflects biological realities for many of the stocks, and they're inappropriate. And you'll hear more about that from Ms. Etree probably later today, at least on one of the stocks. The overall harvest strategy was meant to maintain a low to neutral risk of exceeding the fishing mortality reference. Stock conditions are poor. Fishing mortality rates should be further reduced to promote rebuilding. You got to remember, at the time we adopted this, we had a way to tell at least when Georges Bank Yellowtail was poor, because the Sustainable Fisheries Act required a biomass reference point. There is no biomass reference point in the U.S.-Canada understanding. So over the years, at times, there's been disagreement about what should trigger this stock conditions are poor, reduce F requirement. And there's been at least one instance where we didn't reach agreement because of that. The other element here, this is about the only time I'm going to get any detail, is the TMGC uses track advice. It's supposed to use the advice from the track. So the next piece, next slide, is we negotiate that allocation. And this went back and forth over time. I'm not going to go into those details. I'll talk a little bit about how it was negotiated. It's sort of unique that the understanding agreed that we would base the allocation on a combination of two factors, current resource distribution, and current needs to be taken with a grain of salt, and catch history that was developed over this time period shown here. One of the things we did is we came to agreement on the catch history. That was something that actually had to be talked about, what was included and everything else. So then there was a formula created that said, okay, over time, the influence of catch history will decline until eventually the catch history is only, I think, 10% of the decision here, and the rest of it's based on current distribution. We are well past when that happens. So at present, the catch history is about 10%, and the resource distribution is 90%. The catch history scaled down over time. Next slide, please. I want to emphasize this point. Some people have floated the idea out at times over the years that we should revise the allocation formula. It was a negotiated agreement. Neither country got exactly what it wanted. The Canadians did not want to consider any catches before the ruling on the U.S.-Canada boundary. You saw from the previous slide that we went back into the 60s, so obviously they didn't get on that. They wanted to downweight resource use during that period since the U.S. did not have a hard quota. U.S. history was developed in part from areas that are no longer under U.S. jurisdiction. The Canadians felt that was unfair because they didn't think we should get credit for something that was no longer ours. We wanted to treat the landings and surveys the same. We wanted to consider the entire time series of landings. We actually at one time put forward the idea that because we spent more money on assessing stocks on Georges Bank, we should get credit for those investments over time, and that should be factored in. You know, so this was all negotiated. I'm going to talk a little bit about resource shares and how they were worked. You'll see examples of this in the track presentation. The final agreement used these two factors. I've talked about this a little bit, so I won't really repeat it. I'm not sure I would put this slide there because I've already covered all this. So let's move on. Next slide, please. How the surveys are used, they're not quite used exactly the same way. We use our two surveys, spring and fall, and the DFO survey, which they call spring, but it's February. And it's not spring in Canada in February. I don't care what they say. But anyways, so we use the surveys. They're combined. Then after they're combined into an average, the average is smoothed with a low S smoother. This is what I mean. The next step is the one why I say you call it current distribution. That's a little bit of a misnomer because we use the example here is, you know, you take the surveys in year one, calculate the low S smooth, and then that's what determines the distribution in, you know, 2 years later. So it's there's a little bit of a time lag there. The low S smoother does weird things sometimes for those of you who may not be familiar with it. A key feature of low S is that if you have an outlier, it downweights the influence of an outlier. This can lead to strange results. Back in 2012, when you did this survey, my recollection is the proportion of Georgia's yellowtail on the US side of the line was something like 84%, you know, a really high number, 80%. Because LOAS downweighted that outlier, that year our share of Georgia's bank yellowtail went down. Had that number actually been lower, our share would have gone up. So this, you know, as you can imagine, on the U.S. side of the line, we're like, what? You know, how did this happen? It created a lot of flurries and stuff. At the time, we went back and looked at the lowest smoother, and while that happens, there was really no evidence of a consistent bias. You know, some years, if you looked at all of the things, you know, this was in 2012, so it's a while ago. It may not still be true. If you looked at all the things, you know, some years, the lowest made our share higher than what the survey said. Some years, the lowest made our share lower than what the survey said, and there didn't seem to be any consistent bias. It's just the way it works. So this next slide is just to show you how the U.S. shares have changed over time. If you look at that 2011 to 2012, I believe that's yellowtail flounder. That's kind of, it was the 2011 one, I think, that went down, and then 2012, it jumped back up. You know, that's kind of the weird year in there that I was talking about. If you go on to the next slide, this is another bad joke. But anyway, this is a slide that's taken from Amendment 13, where we adopted the U.S.-Canada Resource Sharing Understanding. I apologize for the quality. I think we used Gutenberg's printer when we did this. I have no idea why it looks so bad, but it looks this bad on the other page, too. So this is the process that's followed, and you can see that, you know, we create TORs, we hold the track, both the council and the Canadians, or I should say the U.S. side and the Canadians go out to their public and try and get some comments. Then we have our TMGC meeting. Ideally, the TMGC meeting here, it says July or August. That never happens anymore. The TMGC meeting is always in late August or more likely in September. And then we ideally come to agreement. Then each country goes back into their management process, and you'll do this today, hopefully. You agree on what came out of the TMGC, and then we both try and implement it. Within the red box, you'll see a little arrow that goes off to the side where occasionally we don't agree. And if we don't agree, when I say we, if the council doesn't agree, the council can actually refer it back to the TMGC and they try and renegotiate. There have been times where we didn't reach agreement on a stock. One time we did not reach agreement on Georgia's Bank Yellowtail Flounder. The Canadians wanted a higher number than was consistent with our law, so we never did reach an agreement. I'll get into that a little bit. Another time, I think we renegotiated the number. I'm not going to go into why. It's kind of, I just won't go into it. So there's been at least twice where we had to renegotiate, once where we were successful and the next time when we were not. There's another element of the agreement to be aware of. There was a concern expressed, you know, it's an understanding, right? And so there was some question, if you look in the Magnuson Act, you get some flexibility on rebuilding if you have a treaty, an international agreement. Well, you know, the agency determined, I think accurately, that this is not an international agreement. It's never really been negotiated. It's never been ratified by Congress, so it doesn't meet the terms of an international agreement. So that wasn't covered in the, by the Magnuson Act. So instead, there was a law passed that initially started out as the IFACA, the International Fishery Agreement Clarification Act. It eventually got rolled into the Shark Conservation Act, of all things. And it basically said that the Secretary of Commerce and the Council can take into account the understanding and decisions made under that understanding to extend your rebuilding period. As long as overfishing does not occur, it has to be ended immediately. So essentially what this meant, it only applies to George's Bank Yellowtail Flounder. That's the only real stock that we have in the understanding at present. It essentially means that your rebuilding people period can extend out to whatever it would be under FMSY. That's kind of in a shorthand, which was kind of important because there have been times under George's Bank Yellowtail Flounder when we had an assessment where the rebuilding period was far longer and the F was far lower. So this gives us some flexibility. One thing I will note, and this is something that sometimes gets questioned, the TMGC as members are well aware of this. When we negotiate George's Bank Yellowtail Flounder, we always walk in the room knowing what the SSC has set for the ABC. This law does not exclude the SSC from the process for a U.S. stock. When the original agreement was being negotiated, some of the early drafts said that the SSC would be taken out of the loop under these situations. But that did not survive. That was taken out before the bill was passed. So moving down to my next slide, this is one of the things that I mentioned just now. The yellowtail flounder subject to the SSC specification of an ABC. Eastern Georgia's haddock and Eastern Georgia's cod are not, because they're a management unit. They're not a whole stock. But, and Jamie's going to go into this in some detail shortly, the quotas on the Eastern Georgia's affect what's available for the U.S. This gets exacerbated when we have different assessment models or different mortality targets. Management track assessment timing can make this difficult at our TMGC negotiations because the TMGC members may not know what the George's cod or George's haddock quota is going to be, and so they don't know how much to give to Canada. And essentially, the more quota that's under the U.S. understanding, the less quota is available for the U.S. as a whole, generally speaking. Perhaps not exactly accurate. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to the doctor here, and she's going to go into a little more detail on these issues.
Thank you. I have three slides to run through, and then we'll return back to Tom. The first is on, all three of them are on what happened with last year's allocation process. And so you've seen some of these slides before from me about how do we walk through from all the recommendations to what's available for the fishery. So the first one here is George's Bank cod. Based on last year's process, the SSC determined the OFL is unknown and an ABC of 754. We also had the TMGC process. And at the conclusion of that, the recommendation was for that eastern area that the total allowable catch should be 571. So you see that value in parentheses next to the ABC. So keep those two in mind. So the first step in the process of going from the total ABC, which is 754, to what would be called the US ABC, is to deduct the proportion, deduct the amount that's available for the Canadian fishery. So of that Eastern Georges Bank TAC of 571, 411 was going to Canada in the eastern area, and then 160 was going to the US. So we take that 754, we deduct the 411. That's where we come up with 343 metric tons available for US fisheries right now in this fishing year. The next steps in the process include accounting for fisheries we call the subcomponent analysis. Many on the committee are very familiar with the subcomponent analysis. This involves trying to do our best guess of what the state fisheries will catch and other federal fisheries that are not groundfish commercial. And so this is the place where we make an educated guess about commercial catch of cod in state waters fisheries, other bycatch, and then the recreational fisheries catch is also accounted for in the recreational catch target in that bin. So deducting the 11.2 and the 74.9 and reducing that amount for management uncertainty, that results in the 243.9 metric tons available for the sector and common pool. So that's how we go from 754 to 243.9 available for the commercial fishery from start to finish. A similar process is followed for Georges Bank haddock with some differences. There is an OFL for haddock and an ABC. And so last year, the agreed upon total allowable catch in the eastern area was 14,100. Of that, the available portion for the Canadian fishery was 7,473. You see that all the way to the left. When you subtract that value that from the TAC in the eastern area, the US had 6,627. That number is not on the screen. But what you do want to see is, okay, what value, we take away that Canadian portion from the ABC to determine now what we call the US ABC, and that's everything else I'm going to talk about, what's available for now US fisheries. We don't set aside anything for state waters fisheries. This is on Georges Bank, so that's zero. And there is a small amount caught in other fisheries that don't currently have an ACL, so we have a small amount set aside there. That's the 406. Again, that's a kind of best guess of what we think could be caught. And then the midwater trawl fishery has a sub-ACL for Georges Bank haddock, and that's currently 2% of the US ABC, not the total. So that value right now this fishing year, after you apply a 7% management uncertainty buffer, is 1,514. And the remaining portion after a 5% reduction for management uncertainty is 75,381 metric tons. And so that's for the US commercial fishery, that sector and common pool in that bin. So that's how we go from that 89,000 metric ton ABC down to what's available for the US fishery. I want to say one more thing about this before I move on. So in the case of Georges Bank cod and Georges Bank haddock, because we have an eastern management unit and a western management unit, a few years ago, the council put in a provision that was approved that allows sectors to move fish from the east to the west, the quota. They can't move it back. It's a one-way transfer. And they can fish that fish that they would have fished in the east now in the west. It has to be approved by the regional office in order to do so. And so we have seen that sectors, when the cod quota in particular this year has been lower, they've been taking advantage of that option to move some of that eastern quota to the west. So last stock is Georges Bank yellowtail flounder. A little bit more complicated, a little bit more fisheries involved. On the right-hand side, you see in the bottom part of the figure, the overfishing limit is unknown. The ABC is 200 metric tons presently right now in this fishing year. Based on the understanding and the agreement that was reached last year for TACs, the Canadian fishery is under 78 metric ton quota right now, and the U.S. had 122. It's a little simpler because we don't have to split now between the east and the west. So the ABC, the total ABC, is 200, and the U.S. ABC is 122, and that's also the U.S. TAC. From that, we don't have any state water fisheries that are on Georges Bank, so that's a zero, and there are very few other fisheries that encounter the stock that aren't already have a sub-ACL, so we have a zero estimate there. So there's no subcomponents for this stock assigned. They're all on the right side here, now under various ABCs and ACLs. The scallop fishery has an ABC and an ACL for this stock, And that value this year, after reducing for the management uncertainty buffer, is 19 metric tons. The small mesh fishery, which is predominantly squid and whiting, after a 7% management uncertainty buffer applied, also they have 2.3 metric tons. And then the amount available after that, after the deduction of those two, is available for the U.S. fishery, and that's the sector and common pool, the amount of 97 metric tons. All those fisheries that you see on the right, including what you saw for Georgia's Bank Haddock, they all have accountability measures, their own ACLs, and they work in different ways depending on how overages are, if overages occur. And so that concludes my portion. I'll come back to Tom.
So those of you paying attention probably noticed that I didn't talk about the fifth element of the agreement, which was accountability, because I wanted to wait till Jamie talked a little bit about how it's divided up and the accountability that we have. One of the early parts of the agreement, one of the key parts of the understanding, is both the company, both countries agreed that if we exceeded our Eastern Georgia's, if we exceeded the quota under the understanding, we would take have an immediate payback provision in the following year. Nowadays, when we have ABCs and ACLs and accountability measures in our fisheries, that might not seem like a radical idea. But in the case of groundfish management, in 2004, essentially, we started having hard quotas on the stocks in the U.S.-Canada resource-sharing understanding, which we had not had before. There have been a few instances where one country or the other did exceed, and they did have to have a payback immediately, in the immediately following year. So that plays into sometimes about how some of our accountability measures may happen. Next slide, please. So this is a question that periodically comes up, what happens without an agreement? And this is one of those things that, you know, on the U.S. side of the line anyway, there's a little bit of doubt about exactly what happens with agreement, without agreement. As I mentioned before, we have had one instance where we did not have an agreement on the quota. And the way we managed it at the time is we had our ABC, if you will, the overall ABC. We took an estimate of what the Canadian catch was, the expected Canadian catch would be for that shared resource, and that was deducted from the ABC. That was how we handled it at the time. Now, you'll notice that I didn't say we deducted exactly what was the Canadian share. We deducted what the expected Canadian catch was. And so that might have been a little bit different than what their share would have been under the, if we had reached an agreement. And there's a question of long term. That example happened before the National Standard 1 guidelines were modified in 2016. When the guidelines were modified in 2016, they added a provision which talks about international overfishing and how international overfishing can be addressed on the U.S. side. And it includes some language that says that the U.S. is only responsible for its relative portion of international overfishing. In other words, it implies that we don't have to make up if some other country catches too much. To be honest, I have no idea how that would work in practice. It's an extremely lengthy process that has to take place. I mean, there have to be decisions made that there is international fishing going on, and the Secretary of Commerce has to identify ways to address it. So to be honest, I'm not clear that really provides a lot of flexibility, but it is something that could be explored over the long term. And then the other option, of course, is to revise modify your management or assessment units. You know, there was a time in the not so distant past where that some of these stocks that have Canadian catches were not part of our management unit. Pollock is an example where at one time a pollock assessment considered only pollock in the U.S. didn't necessarily consider pollock on the Canadian side of the line. I don't know if that's still true or not. But that would be another possible reaction. However, that something like that would take time to accomplish. And with that, I'm willing to answer any questions if there's time, Mr. Chair.
We got all the time in the world, Tom. No problem. Any questions for Mr. Neese or Dr. Cornan from the council? Go ahead, Tom.
And I have one follow-up. I was advised after my comment about February not being spring that the Canadian survey actually has lately taken place in March and April. I'm not sure that's spring yet anyway, but.
Ms. Ware.
Thank you, and thank you for this presentation. I really appreciated kind of an overview and history of this.
My question is about Georgia's Bank Yellowtail, since that is for the full stock and we get the SSC recommendation for that. I'm curious what happens if the TAC negotiated at TMGC differs from the SSC's ABC.
Well, maybe this is obvious to everybody, it's worth reminding council members that the SSC recommends a catch level, and we can always set the catch level lower. We can't set the catch level higher. The instance that I can't remember if... So we would have, we cannot, if the Canadians wanted a higher catch, which they did once, we would not be able to reach agreement if it exceeded our ABC. There was one of the times when we had to renegotiate, however, this is something we don't do anymore. The SSC met after the TMGC. The TMGC members agreed to a yellowtail flounder quota, and the SSC, after the TMGC meeting, set the ABC higher than the TMGC quota. And when we got to the September council meeting, the council gagged at the idea that they were going to set the quota lower than what the SSC recommended. They rejected the agreement. We went back and negotiated with the Canadians, and they agreed to the higher TMGC quota that matched our ABC.
All set, Megan. Mr. Beardnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Neese, for your presentation. I greatly appreciate it. I have ICAT on the mind and thought there was some similarities, but you know, the details were provided that that I really needed to hear. I have a question. I mean, you use Pollock as an example, and we have other examples of, let's say, menhaden or striped bass or mackerel or other species which, as a result of climatic shift, are moving into the Canadian waters. Is there a mechanism? What's the mechanism then when the time comes, if the time need be, that we now have to manage this collectively with Canada? How does that work?
I'm probably not going to give a very good answer here. I don't think there's any requirement that we manage collectively with Canada. The resource sharing understanding, we only came to agreement on three stocks. Over the years, at times there have been ideas surfaced that we should expand the understanding to include other stocks. At one time, there was, I don't know if it was a serious discussion, for example, but there was the idea surfaced to manage mackerel under the U.S.-Canada resource sharing understanding, which would potentially dramatically complicate things, because now you're talking about having two councils involved, not just one. But none of those have been followed up on. We have the Transboundary Management Guidance Committee, and if you squinted and looked at the flow chart that I showed, you would have seen that there's a group called the Steering Committee, the U.S.-Canada Steering Committee, and they're sort of the umbrella organization that we're under. It primarily consists of the regional administrator and his counterpart in Canada, though that there are other people that participate in the process, but they're really the decision makers. This committee doesn't operate really by consensus of everybody who's there. You know, it's conceivable that through that steering committee, we or the Canadians could raise the issue that we might want to incorporate another stock in some sort of joint management approach, not necessarily under the same understanding, but under some similar approach, and that could happen. I don't know if any, I haven't heard that any of those discussions are currently ongoing. Have you? Yeah. So I don't think that's anything right now that's going on.
All set, Mike. Okay. Mr. Tracy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Tom, maybe you said this, maybe I missed it, but why these three stocks?
Yeah, I don't really know. Okay. I mean, I think these... So if you go back historically on the U.S. side of the line, our management plan originally started where we focused on... If we're going way back now. Our management plan for groundfish really focused on managing cod, haddock, and yellowtail flounder, and everything else was sort of managed because we're addressing those three. Then over the years, the other stocks got added to the management unit. I think that the feeling, you know, there were years when the Canadians landed flounders on George's Bank but never identified what the flounders were except for yellowtail. I think in some cases relatively recently they started tracking what the flounders were. So I think the real reason was those, if you go back to the 90s, those three were really the big three on George's Bank. I mean, haddock sort of was, except it was crashed in the mid-90s. Cod was extremely important to both the Canadians and us, and yellowtail was extremely important to the U.S. I mean, I forget our number this year, but we're talking about a couple hundred tons of yellowtail flounder. You have to remember that if you go back to the 2000s, in 2004, I think we landed about 6,000 metric tons of yellowtail flounder. So it was a very high-value fishery, and I think that's what they focused on.
So all set? Thank you. Okay. Anybody else from the council? Mr. Alexander.
Thank you. Could you go back to slide 11, please? Just looking at the yellowtail flounder there, it looks like there was, in the terminal part of the graph, there's four straight years of declines. And in the resource distribution counts for 90% of the share, right? So it's kind of tempting to say that might be consistent with some kind of climatic trend or something, or rain shift. Was there any discussion of that, or has anybody noted that?
That might be a question for Dr. Ten Brink after me. You know, the reality is that these surveys on George's Bank are catching very few yellowtail flounder these days. And so these proportions are, by very few, I mean, there have been surveys out there that have probably caught, you know, their toes that catch one or two yellowtail flounder. And I think part of that, you know, it reflects that the stock is seems to be in extremely poor condition on eastern Georges or on any part of Georges Bay. I don't know if that's fully explained by climate issues or what, because it's been going on for a while that it's been declining pretty rapidly.
Anybody else from the council? Dr. Hare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll figure out how to raise my hand online. I guess for awareness, you know, we've been working with Canada Department of Fisheries and Ocean on science issues, you know, not working on species that are part of the track. We have a working group looking at Atlantic mackerel. These working groups are focused on science solely, but they were, you know, set up with the intent to sort of have U.S. and Canadian scientists working together on a particular species, which could lead to conversations about management in the future. We also recently set one up on American eel. American eel is, you know, managed by the states. But my point is that there is opportunity to sort of have conversations about sort of setting up working groups to work on the science of species which cross the boundary, if there is interest. And so, you know, thus far, it's Atlantic mackerel and American eel. We're sort of stepping into that slowly. But there is opportunity to sort of set these working groups up to look at other species that may be of more interest to the New England Council. But we have avoided the species which are part of the track and TMGC relationship.
Well, Mark, you all set? Okay. Seeing no other hands from the council, anyone from the public? Seeing none, back to the council. Mr. Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Hare, I just have to ask then, what if that opportunity exists, what is the mechanism to request the additional species? Is it the council? Is it? I'm just not clear how that works.
I think it would just start as a conversation, perhaps over coffee.
We'll have it over beer, thanks.
Excellent suggestion. Thank you. Okay. Seeing no other hands, thank you very much, Doctor, Mr. Neese, for the presentation. Let's move on to our next topic, which is the track. Dr. Ten Brink, whenever you're ready. I'll take this pause to remind everybody to please fill out your committee requests. I can't forget that. So I don't know how many we've gotten so far, but we haven't gotten them all. So don't forget.
Let's start with, okay, COD. This is fine. You can make it full screen. So first I'll give the update on Eastern Georgia's Bank COD. So here you can see the area that we're discussing on the right. I'm gonna go through these relatively fast, so feel free to just tell me to stop or we'll return to the slides later. Here are the terms of reference to update the biological and fishery indicators, as well as an update on recent assessments for bordering or overlapping stocks, compare the assumptions of the DLM model, and provide advice. Here you can see the surveys that were included this year and the fishery data. So this is a survey distribution of cod throughout Eastern Georgia's Bank. There was different information between the DFO and NOAA Fisheries Spring 2022 surveys. Here on the survey length frequency, you can see that the lengths of the fish are clustered around 40 to 75 centimeters with a peak at lengths 40 to 45 centimeters in the NOAA Fisheries 2021 fall survey. This is showing the growth, and you can see here there has been a change in how the fish are growing that has been noticed in the surveys. So if you see the blue or aqua dots, colored dots on the top graph, they're tracking along the top of the red point cloud. And this shows that the 2021 to 2022 fish are growing faster than has historically been seen. However, then you see that they kind of level out on the rest of the graph. So I'll discuss this later when it comes to violating the assumptions for the DLM tool, because this is what it refers to. So in terms of the changes in indicators, there was a decrease in landings and catch, but the proportion of the quota that was caught was similar to last year. Fish size increased slightly for the Canadian catch in 2020. In the 2019 fishing year, the 2015 to 2017 year classes contributed more to the catch, while in the 2020 fishing year, this was not evident, and the 2018 year class dominated. So the swept area abundance on the DFA survey decreased significantly from 3.3 million fish to 1.1 million fish. Condition decreased for both males and females on the DFO survey. However, it increased from 2019 for both males and females on the NOAA Fisheries Spring survey. Total and relative mortality was not calculated. So based on the data available this year, there's no drastic change in stock status, and we have a current basis for no change in catch advice from the last year's model. So here, you've all seen this, the U.S. domestic assessment, where the catch advice domestically was cut around half from the previous year. In terms of the Canadian assessment, it's called the 4X5Y COD overview, and there has been only bycatch allowed since the 2019-2020 year, with the lowest removals on record. So this year we use the DLM tool where we have parameters in the simulation which are based on the survey data up to 2018. So the test of the parameters feeding into the projection are the length, weight, growth, and maturity. If empirical data depart from these assumptions, then the projections for the DLM tool depart from reality and are no longer considered valid. So here you see the green rectangle is the range of data used in the simulation. If the points fall outside the green rectangle, the assumption is no longer true. So the length weight assumption holds for 2022 as all the black points are in the green rectangle. Again, in terms of maturity, the maturity assumption holds. This is the one to note that the points are almost out of the green boxes here, which is potentially breaking assumptions for the DLM tool soon, with the growth parameters that are almost outside the box. So for this year, based on the approved management procedure selected by the TMGC, the advice for 2023 is 520 metric tons and remains appropriate. So 520 metric tons is the lowest bound of the DLM tool simulation. Available survey and fishery indicators generally remain consistent with previous years, indicating the productivity of the stock remains low and there's no notable change in the state of the stock. So we need to continue annual evaluation of whether assumptions made for the projections remain realistic, particularly if further advice of higher than assumed growth emerges. Also, this DLM tool is only intended as a short-term solution and should be replaced or supplemented with at least one functioning population model as soon as possible. So TRAC strongly recommends a benchmark for this stock. And here are the special considerations. So as it notes, we need to monitor the growth rate. Can we turn it over to the yellowtail? So here you can see in the lower right corner the area that we're discussing. In terms of the terms of reference, it's to update the latest information, provide catch advice based on the limiter approach, and examine results. So the limiter approach was developed during the 2020 TRAC meeting and subsequently enhanced during TMGC intersessional meetings. So last year, TMGC recommended the use of the limiter approach for the catch advice for this year. The limiter is a tool to help make decisions regarding the constant catch advice and average survey biomass limits to respond to low catches and poor condition of the stock, along with the desire to stop chasing survey noise. The limiter approach has 1,000 metric tons as lower limit, and the upper limit has been raised from 7,300 metric tons to 8,500 metric tons. Catch advice, the average survey biomass for 2022 was 1,500 metric tons, which is between the limits, and then adjusted for the missing DFO survey, it was 1,211 metric tons, which is still between the limits. Therefore, TRAC recommends the constant catch advice of 200 metric tons. So, in 2021, the combined U.S. and Canadian catches were 51 metric tons. The majority of catch now is from discards. The figures show the catches in quota from Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder. You can see how the catch has gone down and stayed down since about 2014. The table on the right is a zoom-in of the figure on the left. So this figure shows the coefficients of variation for the U.S. discard estimates for Georges Yellow Bank Flounder. You note that the high value for 2020 is due to limited observer coverage and the scalp dredge fee as a result of COVID-19. These are highly uncertain estimates due to less observer coverage. This is something we'll dig into further with the research track. Here you can see the surveys, the three survey biomass indices. Note that the 2020 NOAA Fisheries spring and fall surveys were not conducted due to COVID-19. And the 2020 DFO survey data is not available due to a change in vessel and an absence of the conversion factor. So surveys still remain low in recent years. Here you can see the coefficient of variation. There's a lot of uncertainty in the estimates. However, it's going to be looked at further in the research track, and the uncertainty in this update is consistent with past estimates. In In terms of the time series, these are the three surveys that go into the assessment, and this shows the bottom trawl catch survey catch rates in biomass with 90% confidence intervals as the gray area. So, in terms of survey recruitment, the age 1 and 2 fish are low in the surveys and catches remain low, especially in recent years. So the empirical approach is how to plan for catch advice applying a 7% exploitation rate with an average taken across the last 3 years. This is without the survey adjustment. There has been uncertainty because every year since 2020 has been missing a survey value. So this method results in a catch advice of 105 metric tons. So historically, we take the surveys, expand up to biomass estimates, average the surveys, explain and apply the exploitation rate used for the catch advice. So adjusting for the missing DFO data, having no DFO data leads to a slight overestimate, so we apply an adjustment factor to get from 1,500 metric tons to, as you see here, 1,211 metric tons. However, if we use the limiter approach rather than the empirical approach, it is still between the bounds, and therefore the catch advice is the lower bound of the limiter approach, which is 200 metric tons, which means that there is a projected exploitation rate of 16.5. So here are some special considerations you can read at your leisure. I'll turn it over to the final stock. So here you can see the area for Georges Bank Atlantic haddock. So the terms of reference were to update the following biological and fishery indicators of the state of the haddock, as well as comment on these changes in survey and fishery indicators, provide catch advice based on the Eastern Georges Bank assessment model, and recommend fishing reference points. So the total catch of Eastern Georges Bank haddock in 2021 was 7,526 metric tons of the 14,100 metric tons combined Canadian-US quota. So that was 53% of the total quota caught. Canada caught 92% of the quota and US caught 8%. Here you can see the recent strong year classes of years 2000, 2003, 2010, and 2013. The 2003 cohort made up 33% of the total catch, followed by the 2018 year class at 24%. Catches of age 1 fish are the highest since the 2013 cohort. Here's some information on the survey data. There's new length-based conversion factor of big low catch, new season by year biomass calibration factors, and how updated the surveys are in this model. So this model is based on several of the methods from the haddock research track. However, it adds 2 more years of data. So this is the survey biomass index with updated survey data for DFO only. And for 2021, all 3 surveys show low biomass with an average